author and teacher John Lash is one of the most forefront exponents of the power of myth to direct and shape an individual's life. John is a lifelong student of world mythology, alchemy, astrology, naked eye astronomy. He's also the co-founder, principal author of metahistory.org. In addition, John founded the Institute for Creative Mythology in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Here he is on Coast to Coast. John, it's been a couple of years since you've been on the program. Welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. I think it's been two and a half, something like that.
Man, it goes by fast, doesn't it, when you're having fun?
Really.
What have you been up to over the last few years?
Well, you know, I finished a big book, which came out in after my interview with you. It came out in November 2007, and since then I've kind of been relieved to get that book done because it was a master task that had about 40 years of my life in it. And so since then, I've been developing some new material and working on the website, metahistory.org, and doing some other creative projects relating to screenplays and kind of edging toward the movie world, actually.
Good for you. We got a lot of response when you were on with us a couple years ago, John, so I'm looking forward to our discussion tonight. In the movie end, is it going to be fact, based on... fiction based on fact, or what's the approach?
Well, the approach is very direct. One of the events in my life that was a quite destiny-shaping event that impacted my whole life was that when I was a young man, around 20, back in New York City at the height of the psychedelic revolution, I met a young girl, and we became very close friends. We were married, and we became good friends for 28 years, and it happens that she was the daughter of a kind of literary icon in the United States named Jack Kerouac. And so through Jan, through knowing her, I now have control of some of the properties of this writer, Jack Kerouac. And I'm developing them into screenplays.
And you're getting some interest?
A great deal of interest, yeah.
Good
the
for you,
primary one that I'm working on right now has a great deal of appeal because it sort of falls into the area of, in a way, the whole Harry Potter kind of genre.
Okay.
Jack Kerouac was most famous, you know, for his novel On the Road.
All right.
And, yeah, and he was called the King of the Beat Generation.
His approach... very unlike most authors, if I recall.
Yeah, he kind of founded a whole style of his own. It's basically a kind of a rambling, some people even say a drunkaholic style. Yeah, because Kerouac's novels, there are about 16 of them, none of them really have much of a story structure. They just kind of ramble on, and he goes from one adventure to another. And he was famous for this kind of style because... it was a very freeing way to write, in the 1950s during the Cold War and in the post-war period. And so he became, as many people know today still, although some people don't know who Kerouac is, he's a major, major literary icon of the 20th century in America. And I'm involved in developing some of the properties that have come to me through my connection, lifetime connection with his daughter, Jan.
That sounds exciting. Well, we look forward to seeing some of these put on the big screen, maybe.
Well, I was just saying there's one of them that kind of relates to the Harry Potter movement. Actually, the favorite book that Jack Kerouac himself wrote, that he said was the favorite of all his books, was kind of a childhood memoir, and it's a fantastic book. It's called Dr. Sacks, and it's a story about his growing up in Lowell, Massachusetts, in a very poor factory town in the 30s. And he, as a young Jackie, who is himself, is a very bright kid. He writes a lot. It's based very much on how he did live and on his true character. But the real appeal of his story, Dr. Sacks, is that young Jackie, this American boy living in the 30s, has an imaginary friend, this wizard named Dr. Sacks. And he has adventures with this wizard. And he and Dr. Sacks and a group of other kids battle the power of evil, who is represented by... a great white snake surrounded by these Catholic cardinals. And so the whole story is a fantastic story of kind of like the confrontation between innocence and evil, you could say. And it's a beautiful book for developing a film that has kind of special effects mixed in with real life kind of footage. I'm sort of thinking of, you remember Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh, yeah, great. Animation with live.
Animation with real life. And this is how I'm developing Dr. Sex. I'm working with a colleague and co-writer, Madonna McMagnus, who lives in New York, and she's been sort of acting as a publicity agent for this. And we're developing this screenplay together and to actually taking it to Hollywood right now. It would make a fantastic movie sort of on the order of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, because the animation of the wizard and his magical and his opponents would go beautifully with the real life footage. It's a great, great story, very inspiring. And as I said, Jack Kerouac himself said that it was the best thing that he ever wrote and his most beloved work.
Well, look us up, John, the next time you're in Los Angeles, where I spend a lot of my time doing the shows there. So
I sure will. We might be coming into town to talk about the film. It's well in the stage of development. The screenplay is well on the way to being written.
Let's get into some of these incredible areas that you have investigated through mythology and ancients over the years. First of all, how did you get interested in this?
Well, I got interested because as a child I had some kind of supernatural or paranormal experiences. And lucid dreaming, from the age of four, I remember my first lucid dream was at the age of four. And then I had a Kundalini experience. Do you know about that?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Some people have reported this, you know, that they don't have to go to yoga school and study under the masters to have the Kundalini experience. It can happen to people spontaneously. That happened to me when I was about 16, and it was extremely traumatic. So basically, I was traumatized by the time I was a teenager, and I went in search of some solution or some understanding of what the heck had happened to me. And the first direction I wandered into was yoga. And, you know, Asian mysticism, Asian philosophy, and so forth. And then gradually, I got into mythology and into the various layers of what we call, you know, esotericism.
Did you ever, I went in through the Silva mind studies.
Yeah, Silva mind control, yeah.
Yep, mm-hmm. I love that. I read a book, The Three Magic Words by U.S. Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
That was captivating. In my area, pretty similar, I guess, to yours, just led me into this obsession with trying to get some answers to some of these. But you went even farther back. You went back into the ancient texts and things like that. How far back did you go?
Well, I've gone back about as far as you can go. I mean, as far as you can go right now is only back to about 10,000, you know, BC, when we pick up from the last ice age, and then we have, of course, we start with archaeological evidence and so forth, and then you come forward, and the first civilization you hit is, of course, Egyptian. So I was deeply involved in the study of Egyptian mythology, and that was the first place where I really started to realize my role as a mythologist, which is pretty much, as you know, how I define myself.
As you began to probe and research these ancients, what are some of the things you started stumbling across?
Well, one of the first things that really impressed me, and it's kind of hard to recreate these impressions because it happens, as you know, when you steep yourself in this material.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen if you're just looking at it superficially. But I'll just tell you what my impression was when I began to study the Egyptians. I got the feeling that they had a knowledge of the sciences, of astronomy, of engineering, certainly, that's obvious.
Yes.
And of languages, an understanding of languages, and also a deep understanding of genetics. And I was asking myself, well, how could they have had this knowledge when they didn't have the kind of technology or the resources that we have today?
Mm-hmm.
And I pondered that question for a long time, as many people have, George. And I think I came to the answer that many people come to, because it is the most obvious answer that you arrive at. If they had knowledge that is equivalent to our technological knowledge, say, in astronomy and genetics today, but they didn't have the computers and the other tools, they must have discovered it through their own inner resources. And that was an amazing revelation for me, because it confirmed for me that I would have the same inner resources as them. And so that's what really put me on the quest. And I would say this hit me when I was maybe 22, 23. That's what really put me on the quest to discover what is inside the human potential that allows us to awaken our divine intelligence.
And do you think by doing that awakening, you're tapping into this force out there and picking up that kind of knowledge?
I think the knowledge that the ancients have had, whether it be the Egyptians, the ancient Chinese, the ancient Polynesians, is kind of floating around in the atmosphere. It's there. It's part of the earth itself. Some of it can be found in nature.
The Mayans probably grabbed it too.
The Mayans grabbed it. Each civilization grabbed it and framed it, you know, in their own particular cultural setting. But it is there. It's always been there. And the great key is, the question that we ask is, apart from just making a theoretical study of what the ancients knew, how do we ourselves tap into that source of knowledge? And so very early on, when I decided to take on the vast subject of mythology, and become a comparative mythologist, that is to say, someone who studies and compares the myths of all the cultures of the world, at the same time that I made that life decision around 22, 23, 24, I also realized I was on an inner quest to tap into this divine wisdom potential that is, I believe, the birthright of our species.
I think so, too. Now, what about the possibility, though? And I agree with this incredible possibility of tapping into this force out there. But what about the possibility that they were told it by an advanced civilization that either came down and visited us or might have already been on the planet?
Well, that's a question that we can go around the rose bush many, many times over that question. So I'll give you just my best shot on that, okay,
right,
George? Just think of this, that if there were more advanced beings, whether they had been human beings who arrived at a higher level of intelligence, or whether they were intergalactic beings or beings from another dimension, just imagine if there were those sorts of beings, and I think there's a lot of evidence they do exist, who could have come and imparted knowledge to humanity. Okay, let's accept that premise. But I would add to that a certain critical criterion. I would say that if those higher evolved beings were compassionate to us and took us on as students, then they would act as good teachers act. And in my opinion, a good teacher does not just spoon-feed the information to his students or her students, but actually encourages the students to learn and develop out of their own potential. And so I accept the idea that we were, may have been in some ways instructed by higher beings. I mean, many myths say
okay,
that, you know. But I would qualify it by saying that that is not the only way that we got our information, that a teacher will make you rely and will show you how to rely on your own resources. So it doesn't totally explain the things that we know.
I could buy that, too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, a good teacher will just prime you, will be a catalyst for you to discover what you yourself know and what you yourself can do and to realize your own talents. And I do not accept the idea that we were programmed by a higher intelligence and that nothing that we know comes out of our own essential being. I don't accept that. I think the intriguing thing is to understand what part of it comes out of us as compared to what part of it might have been imparted to us. You know, that's an intriguing question.
You know, I'm also puzzled by the lack of the physical evidence of, for example, if we believe that the pyramids were constructed with incredible knowledge.
Yeah.
That where are the tools? You know,
really.
And where are all these things?
Yeah.
What do they do with them?
That is really baffling. I mean, where are the engineering tools that they constructed those buildings with, you know? It's exasperating. But you almost have to fall back on the premise of some kind of magical technology that they used. For instance, as you well know, I'm sure, one explanation of how the pyramids was built is that they used a sonar, some kind of sonar devices to move these stones. And there was a famous early explorer who went to Tibet in the 30s and left a record of his experiences there, and he claims to have seen Tibetan monks do just exactly this, using trumpets to create a vibrational field that was like a platform, and then on that platform they moved very, very heavy stones. So you kind of have to fall back on that that explanation, unfortunately, because the fact is there is no evidence of what tools they did use. You know?
Of these ancient areas, John, that we're going to talk heavily about tonight, was there one area, whether it was remote viewing, astral projection, lucid dreaming, was there one area that impressed you the most that the ancients possessed?
Really good question there. You mean one particular faculty, one particular path of investigation?
That was so strong, and maybe so baffling.
Mm. Yeah, well, I strongly believe that, you know, in the ancient shamanic seers had a profound connection with the sky. And I believe, as we know, you know, all these great megalithic structures, like from Stonehenge to the Angkor Wat in Southeast Asia to the Pacific Islands to the Medicine Wheel circles and stone circles in the United States to Stonehenge and so forth, all of these great mysterious megalithic structures are aligned to the sky, aren't they? All of them.
Sure. Absolutely.
And so what really impresses me is that the ancients had a visual and cognitive interface with the sky. They could read it and they could use it somehow to orient themselves to everything they did on Earth in their engineering feats, but also everything they did in their social and cultural activities. Because most of the great myths that they used, for instance, in Egyptian mythology, the myths of Seth and Horus, are all related to the stars. Osiris is the constellation of Orion. And there is hardly one myth anywhere in the world that cannot be related to the sky. So what impressed me most was this human mind-sky interface. And I wanted to explore that, and that is why I have become known, and happily to say so, as somewhat of an authority or expert on naked eye astronomy and the understanding of archaeoastronomy and the myths of the stars. That has been a great, great passion in my life. And I believe that in the star connection, there is a connection between the skies and the human mind, but you have to experience it. It's very hard to describe theoretically.
I bet even with today's technology and incredible abilities, the Hubble and everything else that we use, I bet we've only scratched the surface of knowledge and where we're probably going to be at 100 or 200 years from now, don't you think?
Well, in terms of astronomy, that's certainly so. You know, I gave a talk at the London Astronomy Show some years back, and I must say people were absolutely stunned by my opening point in that talk. I raised the idea that we now have these orbiting telescopes and infrared telescopes, and we have all this high-tech gear to explore the universe, right? And we're gathering all this data. And it was only about in the early 80s, using this data, that we were able to ascertain the direction that you look to the galactic center.
It took that long. John, let's talk more about that when we come back, as well as an update on angels and mind parasites and some other things on Coast to Coast AM. Just got an email from someone who says, "Oh, George, I've been working like 15 hours a day. I want to stay up for the show. I'm exhausted. I got to go to bed. What can I do?" Well, I just sent him back an email that said, you might want to consider Streamlink, where you can get podcasting in the morning. And I think he'll like it when he finally reads the email. You can pick up Streamlink, too, for just pennies a day by going to coasttocoastam.com and sign up for it and get podcasting and downloads. And Lex tells me they are pushing forward to expanding that 90-day download of past shows as well. So well worth it for you. We'll be back in a moment with John Lash on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, John Lash, our special guest tonight. And, John, you were telling us about this speech on astronomy. It's a great story. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me wind up the second half of that. I was
sure.
saying that due to all this gear we have now, scientists about in the early 80s, I believe, astronomers were able to say in the location looking out into the galaxy, if you look in this direction, a certain direction of space, you're looking toward the center of our galaxy, which we know we're in this vast galaxy of 200 billion stars, which is like a rotating whirlpool. And they said, well, you can't see the center, but if you look in this direction, it's a sight line, okay? And that sight line is located in about 27 degrees of the sign Sagittarius in the zodiac. And so I pointed out, is my opening point in this talk at the London Astronomy Show, that that's a very recent big piece of information about the structure of the cosmos, right? We know where to look, where the center of our galaxy is. But if you go look at the ancient constellations that are in that area, what do you see? Well, there is a constellation there called Sagittarius, the Archer, and it is a group of stars. And I have to point out, make a very important point here, that when you look at this group of composite stars of the Sagittarius, the Archer, it doesn't look like an Archer. It doesn't immediately suggest, oh, that's what you see, like dot to dots.
Yeah.
The trick is, George, that you would have to be instructed to visualize it as an Archer. What the ancients did is they instructed people to visualize these composite stars as the Archer. And if you do that, they say this star is the hand of the Archer holding the arrow, pulling it back. These stars make the bow. These stars form the arrow. This star is the tip of the arrow. Well, guess what? The tip of the arrow and the direction that the arrow is pointing is exactly the location of the galactic center.
Is that incredible?
That's right. And I started that out, and that got their attention. And then I went on to give them seven other examples of the same kind of thing, that the constellations are pictures that they must be intentional pictures, because when you actually look at them, they don't suggest these animals immediately to the naive imagination. They're intentional pictures indicating that people were shown to look at the sky in a certain way. And by doing so, they were shown aspects of cosmic structure, which we've only discovered in the last 20, 30 years.
That is so amazing.
How is it possible? And then again, going back to the beginning, and I love the way you opened our conversation, because you really come right down to the point. It's like, well, it's great that the ancients knew all these things, but how did they know them, and how can we know them as well? Okay? Mm-hmm. So I had a very key moment when I was riding on a boat in the China Sea from Yokohama down to Singapore, and I met this German aristocrat, this very rich German guy who was traveling, and he was reading this book called The Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramhansa Yogananda. Don't know if you've heard that name.
I sure have. Absolutely.
Yeah, he was one of the first yogis who came to the United States and brought yoga and Indian wisdom over here. Mm-hmm. You know, he was before the guru of the Beatles and all those people.
The Maharishi, right?
Yeah, he was before the Maharishi. Anyway, he wrote this book in 1945. And so I was reading this book on this boat that this stranger, total stranger, had very kindly given to me. I come to this chapter. I just go, wow, wait a minute. Yogananda is being instructed by his master, Sri Yukteswar, in the practice of what is called samadhi, or high-level cosmic attention. And his guru explains to him, Yogananda, if you practice this as the yogis do, you can see at infinite distances. You can actually see the galaxy and the structure of the galaxy with your own eyes. So I thought, hey, here we go. Here is proof from an ancient Indian tradition that we have extraordinary faculties, and those must have been the faculties that the ancients used when they constructed visually these constellations, you know?
I would have loved to have been there, John, just to witness how their mindset worked. Fascinating.
Well, they have the ability, and you can learn this from Yogananda, because he's one of the inheritors of this very, very ancient tradition. They have the ability to take what we call the simple power of attention. And, you know, when you sit down to drive a car, you have to apply attention. When you sit down to solve a mathematical problem, you have to apply attention. And some things require high level of attention. And apparently, or not apparently, but certainly, what these ancients were able to do was to develop their powers of attention to an extraordinary degree that absolutely defies what we consider to be the bounds of the human mind. And they were able to look into the outer structure of the cosmos. They were able to look into the inner molecular structure of matter. And the yoga manuals describe in detail these faculties and how to attain them.
You have done some work into an incredible area about, they're called, and if I'm pronouncing this right, archons?
Yeah, the archons, yeah.
Archons. What are they exactly?
Well, archon is just a Greek word that was very common back in the Christian era, and actually it really meant governor or boss. For instance, each area of the Roman Empire, as you know, was very tightly controlled by the central authority, and so they would have an archon for the area of Palestine or an archon for the area of Alexandria, who was the governor of that. But in a different sense, in a metaphysical and parapsychological sense, this word archon was used to refer to alien mind parasites. And it was used in specific manuscripts written in Coptic and Greek that were lost almost entirely until they were discovered in around 1945. And so if you go into this material, which is called Nag Hammadi, because it was discovered at Nag Hammadi in Egypt, mm-hmm. you find in here the behavior, the appearance, and the motives of these archon or archontic beings very precisely described. And it is absolutely unmistakable that this is a record of what we call ET encounters, alien abduction, the whole theme of the alien intrusion into the genetics of the human race, the attempt to meddle in our genetics. It's all there in these documents. So we'd say 2,000 years ago, when these date from, the seers and shamans of that period were actually able to detect these ETs. They weren't just having random encounters with ETs. They were actually going out and tracking them down and learning their behavior, and they wrote down their behavior, and it's absolutely remarkable to read. There's a great deal of it on my website, as you know, medhistory.org, where I've commented a lot on these particular texts, because to my knowledge, they are the texts that give the most explicit description of alien intrusion, ET, UFO kind of stuff.
And I doubt it was the vivid imagination of the author of the time.
No question about it. It couldn't have been, because the evidence that they give, if you want to call it evidence, how do you know that something is evidence and it's not just fantasy, right? Big question. Well, I call it evidence because it matches so closely the current evidence that we have from the best researchers and analysts, such as Jacques Vallée and John Keel and so forth.
And I love Jacques Vallée. He's a regular guest
on
the program.
Brilliant, yeah.
Super. And his mindset change. His mindset change.
The control program is very connected with what the ancients, how the ancients described these archons, that they are perpetrating a spiritual control program on our minds. It's really, I don't know if I can use this word on the site, but it's really a mind F.K. This is what they do. And it's described brilliantly in these texts.
Do you remember the movie? Now I forgot it. The one with Richard Dreyfuss.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah. Jacques Vallée was highlighted in that movie. The Frenchman was truly supposed to be him.
Yeah, the Frenchman Truffaut, who was a director of French films, played Jacques Vallée, and he's in the opening scene. Yeah.
And he has changed his mindset over the years. He's gone from straight physical ETs to more dimensional creatures.
Yes,
and
I know he has. I know that. And that's also consistent with what you find in these Nag Hammadi materials from the desert of Egypt. You know, they do not describe them. They say that they are entities who can, they are shapeshifters. And they are entities who can, at moments, insert themselves, say, temporarily and often bizarrely, in our three-dimensional matrix of space and time. But essentially, they are not of this planet. They are not of the Earth, and they can't really establish themselves here. So one of the interesting conclusions that I drew, and I hold strongly to this position from those writings, is that these Archon ETs cannot really, they're not really capable of invading the Earth, because the atmosphere of the Earth is actually hostile to them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So they need to be in a friendly atmosphere.
Well, they live outside in the solar system, and this is not my supposition. This is exactly what the texts say. The texts say that the Archons live in the solar system of planets exclusive of the Earth, and that they are inorganic, or what we now would call cybernetic, cyborg entities. They are inorganic entities because the Earth is the only planet in the solar system, our solar system, which has an organic life matrix, as you know. The other planets are inorganic, and that's where the Archons live, according to these ancient texts.
Might these be fallen angels?
No, I don't think so. Okay. You know, the fallen angel mythology is fascinating, and a lot of people have done some interesting work with it, you got to admit. But if you would ask me as a comparative mythologist, if the profile of these Archon mind parasites fits a fallen angel mythology, I would say it doesn't really match. I think the fallen angels are part of another interdimensional manifestation, you know? We, our species, is in touch. We are not alone. I mean, I'm
far from being alone.
I say that on this program, am I?
Well, you won't be the last either.
No, we are not alone. And particularly, we're not alone in our own minds. I mean, that to me is the real dazzling message of this Nag Hammadi stuff. We are not alone in our own minds. And the danger, and this is also what Jacques Vallée says, the danger of the UFO phenomenon is whether or not the ETs are real in a physical sense, ultimately doesn't matter. It's the effect, the queering and warping effect that they have on our minds that matters. That's why he describes them as interdimensional beings who affect our perception more than anything else.
Are they all benevolent?
Well, this is another interesting question, too, and boy, you have to look at this one very carefully. I'll just tell you what I have found in these materials.
Okay.
They're very obscure Coptic materials, and they're not easy to read. You have to really delve into them with a fine-tooth comb. But
and do they do pictures? Do they depict anything with pictures, or is it just
no,
all
there
text?
Are no pictures in them. They're just written text. They sometimes have kind of magical diagrams in them, you know, like you would find in a medieval book of magic, kind of stick drawings and circles. Yeah. Anyway, there are some even more obscure Coptic manuscripts that were not discovered at this fantastic cache that they found in Egypt. And if you go and look in them, you find a very interesting point made, which says that the Archons, there are millions of them, and they inhabit the solar system. They live on the other planets, and they fly among the planets. Their ability to fly through interplanetary space is very clearly defined, okay? Because the Lord of these Archons is called by a very bizarre name, which means Yeldabaoth. And Yeldabaoth means the one who passes freely through space. It also means, very interestingly, the one who appears to be a child. And so that really points me to the grays to me, because, you know, a gray, what does a gray look like? It looks like an undeveloped embryo, right? It looks like a prematurely born being.
So bald, everything.
Yeah, bald with a funny limb. So the one who appears like a child who moves freely through space. But it says that there a very odd thing happened in the early evolution of our solar system, and that is that a segment of these Archons split off and defected and became benevolently oriented toward the human race. And these Archons are given a really strange name, which no scholar of this material has ever been able to explain. And I love this name. It's very odd. The name is Paralimptor.
Paralimptor.
Paralimptor. Paralemptor. And it's a strange name because it begins with para, okay? Now, you want to think of something like paramedic. The Paralemptors is the name given in these ancient texts to the benevolent Archons. Now, scholars are baffled by this word because it's not a real word in Greek. It's like a made-up word. And so they usually translate it as receivers, the receivers. Now, this is very mysterious stuff, George. Very few people know about this, and I would imagine that all kinds of people have talked on your program, and maybe you've never heard this mentioned before.
I've never heard this before.
This is what they say.
All right.
They say that a portion of these archontic beings, these cyborg entities who inhabit the solar system but not the Earth, defected and became benevolently oriented toward the Earth, and they went to the sun. And they live in the area, in the atmosphere of the sun. And one of their roles is to receive people when they die. And that's why they're called the receivers.
Interesting.
And so the benevolent, and I wrote about this on my site, and a number of people wrote into me and said, this is remarkable. I've never heard this before, because when I was dying, I had a near-death experience, or when a friend of mine did, they told me that they saw some kind of ET or Archon entities receiving them in that tunnel of light.
Huh.
And so if there is, I'm not saying that I have the full scoop on this, you know, this is a very weird scenario we're talking about here, but if there is an element of benevolently oriented Archons, then it would be these receivers. This is how they're described.
John,
beings who help us die, essentially.
Any other civilizations, any of them, talk about this?
I have to tell you, this is completely unique material, which only is found in three very rare Coptic manuscripts, one of which is called the Pistis Sophia, or the Faith of
right.
Sophia. The other one is called the Treatise of Our Great Cosmic Power and so forth, or the Bruce Codex. Very, very rare. I've never seen it anywhere else. But of course, you know that if you go now, when you find a weird anomalous information like this is what I do. I go and I look at are there any myths from anywhere in the world that would seem to confirm this? Well, yeah, I can give you two examples. The receivers seem to resemble what the Hopis call the Kachinas of Hopi religion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the Kachinas, as you know, are these spiritual beings who are part of the Hopi worldview, and they are involved also with receiving us and helping us make the transition from life through death into other worlds, you know, because those people don't believe that we don't die, really. Death is just a transition to other worlds. So the Hopi Kachinas would seem to fit the profile of the receivers. And then on the other hand, if you look at Egyptian mythology, and there's a great deal of after-death information in there, isn't there? The Egyptians were totally fascinated what happens to us in the death process and after death. And once again, there seems to be an indication that there are ritualized, kind of stiff, odd, ritualized beings who appear at a certain point and usher people through or receive them into the death experience. So there are some parallels to this very obscure material.
Didn't the Pistis Sophia also say that, you know, after Jesus died, he remained on earth after his resurrection for 10, 11 years, something like that?
Yeah, for almost 12 years, and gave instruction to his disciples. And then after he ascended in an ascended body, he also gave telepathic instruction to his disciples, which was mainly received, as you know, by guess who? Mary Magdalene, who is called in the Pistis Sophia the equal to Jesus and the one who knew all. And she is actually the one who channels the Pistis Sophia. You know, of course, that the Pistis Sophia is like a piece of channeled material. It was channeled by Mary Magdalene, of all people, you know? But that story is very typical of a lot of stories of ascended masters. And, you know, it's not particularly restricted to the Jesus, the story
right.
of Jesus. Yeah.
Hey, John, we're going to take this quick break. Then we'll be right back with you on Coast to Coast AM. Fascinating discussion with John Lash. We'll take calls next hour with him. When we come back, more on Coast to Coast AM. John, you just mentioned the Hopis in their prophecy.
Mm.
It seems that every civilization, whether it's Hopis or Egyptians or Mayans, they all seem to have very similar type stories about the beginning and sometimes the end, or end times, especially.
Mm.
Did you find that in your research?
Well, yeah. You know, I am a comparative mythologist, and so one of the things I do is I look at the parallels, meanings, and structures of these myths. And something I've often pointed out that is not a piece of information that a lot of people take very well is that the prevailing view of all the ancient mythologies and civilizations, Mayan, Egyptian, Hindu, Hopi, whatever you want to pick out,
mm-hmm.
is that the course of human civilization is a decline and not a rise. It's a decline and a decay. And, you know, there are various models of what are called the world ages, you know, various ways. The Hopis have, say, four ages, I think. The Egyptians also describe certain ages. The Hindus talk about the four ages, the one that we're in now being called Kali Yuga, which is something that I write about quite a bit on my site. And when you read all of these and compare them and put them side by side, you find that in the ancient conception, they see human experience as degenerating and declining to a more or less a shabby and often catastrophic end. So you do not find in these ancient cultures the idea that we have of progress and some kind of eternally improving spiral. It's quite the contrary, and it's a very sobering lesson to take from these people. But it's also important to understand why they think that way. And it took me a long time to understand this, but it's quite simple. They think that way because they believe that all humans, all civilizations, begin in a state of kind of Eden innocence. And in that state, we are in harmony with nature, and we are awakened. Our minds are awakened to a higher wisdom. And gradually, over the period of time, we forget that wisdom. We forget our divine beginnings and our divine birthright. And so that is why they believe that every civilization, the Maya also painted the same model, every civilization will eventually decline as we forget who we are and what the sources of our being and our spirit are. And it's a very sobering lesson to take from those people.
Let's get into a little bit of the remote viewing and the astral projection that you uncovered again.
Yeah.
Something that is going on. You compare it to other mythologies and civilizations. It's been going on for a long time, and they're all doing it.
Well, yeah, but these encounters have been going on for a long time.
True.
And essentially, you know, Jacques Vallée made the inventory, as you know. I believe he cites, if you want to go into the textual evidence, probably the earliest known textual evidence or account of an ET or abduction experience is around 1500 BC in some Egyptian papyrus. Now, it's been going on since the beginning of the earth. These encounters have been going on. If the ancient story is true, that these archons were here actually before the earth evolved. That's what the word archon really means when you analyze it. It comes from the Greek root archai, meaning in the beginning or before. They were actually here before we were. And so as soon as our species evolved on earth, we began to encounter them. The encounter has been going on for ages. And the interesting thing is encountering them today. You know, who has encountered them and what have they made of it? You know, I've encountered them many, many times. And I wanted to add, as a footnote to our previous conversation, this mysterious business about the receivers.
Yeah.
Or this might be these defecting archons who are benevolent toward us. Well, I've also encountered some of these benevolent ones. So I've encountered both types.
You know, but if they're benevolent ones, then also there've got to be some that are kind of evil, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, but these texts don't actually use the word evil. They use the word error. They refer to them as, like Jacques Vallée's paraphrase is beautiful, they are messengers of deception.
Of deception, yeah.
Deception and error, but not necessarily evil. They are not portrayed, and it's a really important line to draw here, I believe. They are not portrayed as, quote, satanic, unquote, dark angel beings who brood in some corner of the cosmos and have some very, very evil plan that they're going to come and get us. Not at all. In fact, they're depicted by the ancient seers of the mysteries as being deluded themselves. They're deluded. Their main god, who's called Yaldabaoth, was equated with Jehovah. And one of the things that the shamans of these mystery schools did, which made them very unpopular to the early Christians, was they came out to the Christians and said, oh, by the way, you read the Bible, and there's your God, your father God in the Bible, Yahweh or Jehovah, but we have investigated this character, and we know that he is a demented alien who only takes himself for God. I mean, this has got to be one of the greatest lines that ever came down in world mythology. God is insane, the entity that is taken for God. God is insane, and he's working against humanity, but not necessarily because he has a plan, but just because he's like a psychotic who's kind of out of control and screwing with people's minds. I mean, this is actually the profile. It may sound a bit facetious, but it's not at all. It's a brilliant profile of the mastermind of the archons and the whole archon mentality.
In doing your work, you've worked on the Mayans in 2012, I'm sure, has come up. Have other cultures talked about that year, 2012?
I have investigated the date 2012 from about 20 different systems of ancient chronology, primarily the Mayan, the Aztec, the Egyptian, the Hindu.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to make correlations to see if other time frames, time systems of sacred calendrics, as it's technically called, you know, if they have identified this very same date. And they haven't. There are certain overlaps. Now, I have an entire book on 2012 on metahistory.org, a book of 9 chapters in which I go into this. And I go deeply into the astronomical material because I think it's by looking at the astronomical timing, you know, precession of the equinoxes and all that stuff, that we can really make sense of this 2012 date.
Why do the Mayans seem to be so unique then with this?
I don't know. I have to tell you that I'm a little uncomfortable. I think we're over-focusing on the Mayans in this respect.
We might be, yeah.
Yeah. Just because we have their calendar, you know, which was, I don't know, I'm not a Mayanist scholar, but I understand on the opinion of the experts that the Mayan calendar that ends in 2012 was itself invented around 350 B.C.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And it extrapolates back to a start point about 3000 B.C., and then it extrapolates ahead until 2012, and it's about a 5,100 year period. So what? I mean, that was something. It was an artifact and tool used by the Mayan priesthood for their own obscure purposes, and nobody knows what was on their minds, except that they might have been eating a great many psychedelic mushrooms. You know,
they could have been.
They could have been. They constructed a very arcane system of keeping track of time. And their particular system ran out in 2012, but there is no textual or hieroglyphic evidence, talking about Mayan hieroglyphs, no pictures and stories on these stelae, these standing stones, that tell us what they actually understood would happen in 2012. So we have created an industry of embellishing and elaborating something that they themselves made no comment on. And I think we need to be a little wary of that. My call is that 2012 is just a window of opportunity. It falls into a certain moment of time coming up very soon when we have a window of opportunity to look toward the end of the great cosmic cycle that we are now in, the 26,000-year precessional cycle. And my calculations, based largely on the Dendera zodiac in Egypt, put the end of this great cosmic cycle at 2,216 A.D., that is to say about 208 years from now. Yeah, and so the way that I factor in the Mayan dating into that, that's basically a Hindu-Egyptian date there, George, 2216. And other people have plotted that in, too. I can't mention their names, remember their names right now, but I'm not alone in coming in that ballpark figure. Anyway, I see 2012 as just kind of a horizon point that we reach where we can, some of us, who try and understand the long-term perspective of our species, can look forward toward this true end time, because this is the true end date, 2216. It is the true end date of the 26,000-year cycle of precession.
And that date could come and go. And
and so what? But what interests me is that I do not buy by any way, shape, or form the idea that something is going to automatically happen at 2012 or 2037 or any other time. It's all about the action of our own consciousness and the way our attitude affects reality. So it's a moment of opportunity, but it's not a moment of any kind of prophetic planetary change. I don't see that at all.
And what I don't hear from you, John, also is, you know, some guests will come in and talk extremely doom and gloom, major calamities, catastrophes everywhere. I don't hear that coming from you.
Oh, no, I don't see it that way at all. I see that the rotten parts of our civilization and our social system, that is to say those that are infected with deceit, domination, and control games, will fall away. And there might be some nasty scenes when that happens.
Yeah.
But that's like sort of a corrupted flesh falling away from a healthy being. No, I am totally connected with Gaia and with the power and beauty of the planet, which absolutely transcends any problems that the puny human species can throw at her. I am totally certain of that.
There are a lot of people out there breathing a sigh of relief right now, going, finally, someone who doesn't think it's over for us.
No, I think it's just beginning. In fact, you will find on my site in this new material that I call Planetary Tantra, a totally positive view, but not a naive, make-believe New Age view, but a totally positive vision of how we can live with the intelligence and divine wisdom of the earth and of our own minds, and how we can live in beauty and how we can live in sanity. I mean, I see it coming that way. That's the way it comes down in my reality every day.
Well said. Well, that's good. That's positive, and I think we need that. You, like I, believe that the planet is alive then.
Oh, yeah. The planet is alive, and this is, and you can communicate with the planet. She is alive. The ancients of the mystery schools, who were advanced shamans and seers, communicated with her, and they developed her story.
She instead of he. How come? Why did you say she?
That is a very good question, and I'm afraid that I couldn't fully justify and give you a justified answer to that question on this program, because people have been written into me and objected about this on my site. They say, well, how can you're talking about the earth as divine? Okay, let's call it a divine being, but let's call it it. Let's not say that it's a female goddess planet or a male planet. You know, how can divinity be gendered? Interesting question, huh?
Yeah.
I just have to tell you, George, I can't explain how, but I am totally convinced that it is gendered. And also, every single deep myth that you will read from the past about the gods and goddesses always talks about the gender of the gods. So that is not something to dismiss lightly. I'm sorry that I can't justify it to your minds, but I can only tell you that after a whole lifetime of studying mythology, I find that it's an authentic concept. So I call her by the name she was known in the mysteries, which is Sophia, not Sophia. Sophia, which means wisdom. It's a Greek word for wisdom. And she is the living planet, the Gaia. You may call her Gaia, so I hyphenated this name, Gaia Sophia. What I'm developing on my site now in Planetary Tantra is the whole perspective of how we can have a kind of interactive magic with the planet itself. And that is what would put us as individuals, as well as the human species, on a major course correction. And I totally see that happening in my life every day, and I practice it every day. I'm not just positive for the sake of being positive, you know. It's coming from a background and a foundation of my practice with Sophia and with the divinity of the earth.
You know what fascinates me? It thrills me. It baffles me. And that's the fact that mainstream science and modern medicine will turn to the planet and pharmaceutical companies as well.
Oh, indeed,
to get plants and other remedies from the planet to cure ills and disease, or at least try to. And John, it is absolutely riveting to me to just think that almost everything on this planet can cure some kind of disease or affliction or something that we have. Drugs are made from real plants,
and then they
create them. But I don't understand how the planet knows or how it works.
Well, listen, I totally agree with you. That also, that realization that we have on this planet, particularly in the plant world and in the fungal world, please include it because it's an enormous world.
True.
Of the mushrooms and the mycelium. In the plant world, in the fungal world, in the Amazonian plants, we have everything that we need to cure body,
everything.
Mind,
yeah.
Body, mind, and spirit, everything. And how can that be? Well, she's a good mother. She's a good mother, and she's super, super smart. And so she has, in creating this planet out of her own intelligence, out of her own substance, and I have retrieved the myth of Sophia and the origin myth of our planet. Now, this is a very unique thing that you find on my site. You won't find anywhere else, because I found it in these ancient Nag Hammadi materials. How Gaia, this planet, originated, where she came from, and why she turned into this planet. So this divine intelligence, which is mythologically conceived as female, Sophia, has provided the molecular structure. The intelligence of nature is her intelligence. And all we have to do is connect with it, and the beauty of it and the healing power of it, George, is there is no limit to it. It's all here for us. That's the great tragedy of the human species. It's all here for us, and we overlook it and don't realize that it is. That, to me, is the saddest thing about humanity.
Absolutely. And those of us who attempt to find it or who are finding it, you're way more advanced than most. It's a wonderful feeling, isn't it?
It is. And you know, one of the things that I would like to say as a message to the people living out there is that, listening to this program, is that you have used the term the power of myth for this talk. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of associated with Joseph Campbell, who was a great mythologist and comparative mythologist. He was the one who advised Lucas and Spielberg on the plot of Star Wars.
And, I didn't know that.
Yes, he did.
That's
George
perfect.
Lucas and Steven Spielberg cooked up this whole idea of the Star Wars trilogy. They wanted
the Force and all that.
Yeah. And so he gave them an ancient piece of mythology, which is Persian myth. He gave them a Persian myth of the battle between Ormuzd and Ahriman, between black and white. And they converted that myth that he gave them, kind of the germ of the whole Star Wars trilogy. And I've often been compared to Joseph Campbell. Some people have said I'm his true successor and so forth, which is, you know, very, very flattering. Well, I don't mention that now for that reason. I mention it to point out the difference between Campbell and myself. Campbell was a great, brilliant scholar and a comparative mythologist, but he only studied and compiled received material, whereas I actually am discovering new material and working with interactive myth, myth as an applied way of life, and Campbell never did that. So I feel privileged that I was able to jump off the springboard of a master like that. But the kind of mythology that I am teaching and promoting on my website is interactive, applied mythology. You can actually get involved in it, and
Absolutely. It works. Well, you know, it's like being in a major race where there are four guys on your team, and they give you the baton. And
right,
you
a
know
relay
what?
Race, exactly.
Yeah. And it's handed to you, and you're just taking it another way beyond what the
That's exactly what happened. I was handed that baton.
Stay with us. We're going to talk more. You said something interesting, John, about the planet and how it was formed. I want to get your views on that when we come back. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with John Lash. When we come back, let's get his take on how he thinks the planet was formed. Well, I know you're not a physicist, John, but I'd love to get your take on the Big Bang and how you think this planet was formed.
Yeah, well, I'm not a physicist, and when I tell you what my story is of how the planet was formed, I would point out that it's just another story. Even the Big Bang is just another story.
That's
Nobody
exactly
can prove
right.
that the Big Bang happened. You know, I use the term planetary myth, and you find a great deal about it on my site. I should also mention that I was interviewed in Amsterdam in October by a wonderful man, Jay Widener, who has a site called Sacred Mysteries.
Know Jay well.
Yeah, sacredmysteries.com. Anyways, coming out with a DVD called The Dawn of Planetary Tantra, Sophia Returning. And in this two-hour DVD that he's put together from our interviews in Amsterdam, Jay and Sharon Rose, his partner, prompted me. They said, John, you've written so much about the myth of the goddess Sophia who became the Earth that we want you to tell this myth. So I actually do tell it on this DVD. I think it takes me 15 or 20 minutes. So that's where to go if you want to get the full version. But let me just give you the capsule version of it. But first, I want to tell you why this planetary myth is so unique.
Okay.
When I was studying all the myths of the world, you find things like origin myth very often, like, you know, the origin of fire, the origin of food, the origin of various things. And so naturally, after a certain amount of investigation, I began to wonder, well, where are the myths that describe the origin of the planet Earth among the Egyptians, among the Chinese, among the Persians, among the Eskimos, whoever? And as I went into the mythological material, which is vast, with that question, I found, wait a minute, don't seem to be any myths that describe the origin of this particular planet Earth that we're living on. And then I came up with another question. Well, where is the myth that's going to describe the origin of the human species? You know? And what about the myth that would explain, why the Earth is sentient and intelligent, as you noted, that most riveting and astonishing fact.
Yes.
Okay? Those are three big questions. Origin of the planet itself, origin of the human species on the planet, and why is the planet itself and nature sentient and intelligent? Well, I have to tell you that I have studied many, many myths. I could not enumerate how many. And I have only discovered one genuine planetary myth that answers all those questions. And that is found again in these Nag Hammadi materials and in some other related materials from the early Christian era. So I'll tell you just in a nutshell what they say. They say that it's a galactic myth. You know, our galaxy is a whirlpool galaxy of 200 billion stars. And that this whirlpool galaxy has a core of pure white star material. And then it has the four arms, spiraling arms, which are of coarser material, mm-hmm. coarser matter. They say that at the center of our galaxy, at a very, very remote time, there was a power spike. That is to say that from the pure energy and light at the center of the galaxy, a plume or spike of light shot out. And it shot out directly across these galactic limbs and ended up in the third limb from the center. There are only four limbs. Mm-hmm. And in the third limb from the center, and that's where the solar system and the Earth are located. And so according to this planetary myth of Sophia, the Earth was created by a spike of cosmic energy, a spike or plume of cosmic energy from the galactic center. And I'm not making this up. This is actually what the myth says.
Now, do they explain what caused the spike?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
This is really interesting. They say that at the center of the galaxy, in what scientists would consider to be materialistic science, okay, let's give them that.
Yeah.
Materialistic science would say it's just star matter, it's light in a very molten form, in a very high-powered form of light. But according to this Sophianic myth, the center of the galaxy are currents and torrents of white light, which are actually alive. They're like great snakes or serpents of light. And these serpents of light are the gods, and they're called aeons in this cosmology, which I've translated and restored.
Huh.
And the story is that these aeons at the center of the galaxy actually look out at the worlds that are floating and rotating in the galactic limbs, and they dream and cook up these experiments that could happen in those worlds. This is what the myth says. The divine intelligences at the center of the galaxy are actually observing what's happening in worlds like ours, and there are many, many worlds in our galaxy, you know. There are many Earth-like planets.
I would believe that.
And so this is what happened to one of them. They say that a very weird and unusual thing happened, because usually when these serpent-like, great serpents of light are looking out into the circulating worlds of the galaxy, they project their imagination and their power into those worlds, but they do not actually go there. They stay in the boundary of the galactic center. I tell you, this is so incredible, George.
I've never heard this one before.
Yeah, this is the supreme planetary myth, and there's nothing like it else on the planet, I guarantee you. Nothing else like it in all of the mythology I've investigated.
And by the way, you're doing a great job describing this tonight.
Thank you very much. I've boiled it down over the years. Anyway, they say that among these great serpents of light, which were male and female serpents of light, there was one great serpent of light, and her name was Sophia, meaning wisdom.
Uh-huh.
And she and another serpent of light, who is sometimes called the Christos, got together, kind of like a team, a tantric team, man and woman, and they projected a world into the galactic limbs that are circulating the core. And that's what they normally do. Then they stop. Normally, these gods of the center do not do anything further. It's like they are like scientists who set in motion an experiment, but they don't go interfere in it. They just let it work itself out. But the myth says that this goddess of light, Sophia, became so fascinated and so in love with the possibilities of this projected world that she was pulled out of the galactic center and plunged into that world as it began to evolve. And that was what was the cause of the power spike or plume of light.
She was the plume of light.
She was the plume of light. And this is the myth of the fallen goddess Sophia. And then it describes, and I quote in my book, because in my book, Not in His Image, I give also a 9-episode reconstruction of this myth. No other scholar of this material, George, has ever done this. I'm the only one. And I describe, taken from the ancient sources, that they say that what happened to her was she was not used to being a planet. She never had achieved that level of material solidity. So what they say is that her plume of light came to a point, and that out of that point, it sort of spun into a ball, and that became more and more materially dense because it was absorbing the dense, unrefined atomic matter that is out in the galactic limbs. And gradually, that is actually how the Earth was formed, out of the tip of a plume of absolutely sublime, alive, divine light that materialized into a planetary globe.
Did she basically become the planet?
She became the planet. She is the planet. This is what it says literally in these texts, and this is what I've tried to explain in my restoration of the Sophianic myth.
How does that explain Venus and Mars and Jupiter? I mean, who might they be?
Hang on to your hats here.
Or whatever I've got on right now.
Right. Whatever you got on, right. You people in California, I used to live there. I know about you.
I'm in St. Louis right now, so.
Oh, that's right. They warned me about that. Okay. Anyway, get this. The myth of Sophia from the ancient mysteries says that the solar system was formed from a different process of the Earth. And that the Earth does not really belong to the solar system. It's captured in it.
That may be.
And so the Earth, that would explain the anomaly. Why aren't the other planets of the solar system organic paradises like ours?
And who put us right where we're supposed to be?
Yeah. According to this myth, the actual other planets of the solar system, which are made of inorganic matter, Jupiter, Saturn, Venus, Mars, and so forth, were formed first. And it was like a carousel of inorganic matter, very heavy, like a sort of a Ferris wheel, a carousel of inorganic. And then into that carousel, this unique planet, this living planet, formed of the condensed and materialized light of the goddess Sophia, was captured. The Earth is captured in an inorganic system. It's a living divine entity captured in an inorganic system. I tell you, I have studied astronomy, I've studied science, I've studied the evolutionary theories, and I'm impressed by this planetary theory from the ancient worlds because I think it has a lot to tell us.
And this is the only text that is even close to this, isn't it?
That's right. There is only one source of this planetary myth that I just recounted. Only one source. And you go in my book, Not in His Image, it's all laid out. And the final thing that I would like to add is that when I discovered this planetary myth, I was extremely impressed for reasons which are obvious from what I said at the beginning.
Yes.
It's the only one that describes the actual who was the planetary spirit before she became the planet. But then I found something even more fantastic, that when you go to so-called Gaia theory or the Gaia hypothesis, which is the hottest new scientific idea that states that the Earth it is alive, self-regulating superorganism.
Yeah.
Okay?
I think it heals itself.
Yeah. That the Gaia hypothesis contains points that match and parallel point by point the Sophianic myth of the creation of our planet.
That's incredible.
So if you're looking for, if you're the kind of person who's looking for, quote, scientific evidence that an ancient myth could be true, we already have it. And so this is the great directive myth. Campbell would call this the great directive myth of our time, is the myth of the Sophia. And I have spent the whole last 10 years of my life developing this and got it out in my book in 2007.
You had mentioned almost another burst of light that was along with her, and you called it Christos.
Christos. It's been called Christos. There are different names. One of the things that the ancient seers who developed this story pointed out was that the gods or goddesses, these great serpents or currents of light in the center of the galaxy, like to pair off. They like to work in pairs. And this accounts for the fact that in all the created worlds that we see, there is duality or parity.
Balance.
There is intertwining coils in the DNA spiral. Everything is based on duality or parity because the gods who generate these worlds do it in pairs. And so there is a story about Christos and Sophia emanating the human genome. I'm not kidding you. The human genome, which they call Anthropos, they invented and emanated the human genome in the galactic center, and then they seeded it into the worlds living in the galactic, the planets evolving in the galactic limbs. Now, George, if there's any truth in this at all, then it confirms the so-called scientific theory of panspermia, which proposed about 100 years ago, which says that the seeds of life spread through many worlds.
Absolutely.
The conclusion would be that there are other Earth-like planets with other human beings similar to us living all through our galaxy.
If that's true, then are there other – then those planets must be alive too.
Those planets would each have their own story. I don't know the story of those planets because I haven't discovered a myth that tells us. But I do know that they're out there because the Gnostic –
Where'd you go on the phone here? You're way off.
Oh, am I really?
There you
am I
go.
Back now?
Okay, there you
yeah.
go. Okay.
Because the myth of Sophia says that there was a panspermia emanation, that there is more than one, more than one emanation of the human species, more than one strain.
Offshoot.
More than one strain. We are one strain, and there are other strains of the human species. Seeded from the galactic center, okay, living on other Earth-like planets among the 200 billion stars of our galaxy.
What a great...
That is a picture, and that is the picture from this great ancient myth.
That is something.
It is. It's fabulous.
I'm trying to imagine the people of that time who put the Nag Hammadi together.
They were teams of people, George, teams of observers, remote viewers, teams of people who practiced lucid dreaming. They worked in groups of 16 together, and they developed this vision. It's not the result of one person. It's not the brainchild or the idea of a single genius who lived in the past.
Yeah.
It is the legacy of a collaboration of teams of trained seers, who men and women, who work together over many, many generations. And it is our human birthright. This is a story about who we are and where we come from that, to me, has enormous beauty and potential.
What a great, great story. And I don't say story in terms of a tale.
That's right.
It just makes a lot of sense and a lot of answers. This divine aspect that so many religions have grasped.
Mm-hmm.
How does that tie into this? Is there some connection?
Sure. There's a problem with what religion does with the idea of divine. It basically kills it. It doesn't leave it open-ended and available to experimentation. One of the problems, you see, that the Sophianic myth of the Earth, this is a very important distinction to make technically, as a mythologist, is not a creation myth. The goddess Sophia did not create the Earth. She emanated the vision of the Earth, and then she became that very thing that she envisioned. And mm-hmm. This is called an emanationist mythology. And when we get away from emanationist mythology, we get into what are called the paternalistic and creator mythologies. And they separate us from the creative source. And that is a big, big mistake of religion. It makes a division between creator and creature. You find no such division in the Sophianic myth.
On this planet, we have good people, bad people. We have greed. Mm. We have benevolent people. We have disease. We have healthy people. Why do we have that? Why do we have the bad aspects of life?
There is an element of the planetary myth of Sophia that also explains how human beings can become deviated. And I have talked a lot about this, about how we are deviated, how our species becomes deviated, and these deviations lead to disease, to disharmony with nature, and to deceit, domination, and division among ourselves, and from that, hence, all social and historical problems. Why does this happen? According to this myth, the goddess Sophia and the Christos when they envisioned the human species, they gave us a very special faculty of imagination, which is called in Greek, epinoia, the luminous epinoia. And other animals like whales or bees or donkeys don't have this ability of imagination, which allows us, human species, to project our minds into models and into model things and imagine things in the future.
And make them happen.
And this is a great gift of ours, but there is a problem, that when we use that gift incorrectly, it leads us astray from our relation to the earth, and we become deviated. So it's a very elegant solution, I think. It's like saying, what a lesson in this. Listen, your greatest faculty, your most unique faculty of humanity, imagination, which, note well, does not make us superior, it only makes us different, is also our greatest handicap if we do not use it correctly. And, of course, it leads to deceit, because people have to imagine false scenarios to deceive other people, don't they?
And I guess we're the only ones who can solve it.
We're the only ones that can solve it, because we're the only ones with that particular gift. If you look at other animals and you look through the kingdom of nature, the birds, the insects, and the animals, you don't find the capacity for deceit and manipulation that comes anywhere close to us. I mean, we are monstrous in that respect. And yet that monstrosity, that monstrous trait, is the reflection of our divine endowment. And therein lies a pretty sobering lesson.
I want to give out your website again, John. It's meta, M-E-T-A, history.org. We'll be back with John Lash. Now we're going to open up the phone lines. We've got an hour to go with him, and it'll be your turn. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we've had this wonderful opportunity to listen to comparative mythologist John Lash tonight, and now we're going to take your phone calls with John when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. John, in your work, is there one culture, one civilization that simply got it more than the rest?
Oh, no. One of the things that's so fascinating about the study of these ancient cultures is to say that when you get into them, you realize that each one of them had its own particular genius. And that's what you love about it. You know, the genius of the Egyptians was one thing. Genius of the Chinese was another. The genius of the great tribes of the American Indians. And the only way that and they're all relative in that respect, but the way that I look at it is I'm interested in those cultures whose genius was connected with the intelligence of the earth and the divinity of the earth. And so I, you know, tend to give more value, you might say, to those cultures who were deeply connected with this earth goddess that we've been talking about.
Interesting. Now we're going to go
and
east.
Some were more than others, yeah.
But they all added to the mix, didn't they?
They all added by the, as I say, the creativity and genius of their particular people in their regions, yeah.
John, we're going to Robert, who called us. He was so excited to talk with you, he called 3 hours ahead before you even came on.
Oh, my God.
Let's go to him now. Robert, there you go. And you got your moment, Robert. Go ahead.
All right. Nice to talk to both of you. I've had, over the last few years, incidents with sleep paralysis, which originally just scared the bejesus out of me. But I've come to learn that there may be some connection with that and lucid dreaming and astral projection and remote viewing. And I just want to know what your take is on that and if there's something I should be doing maybe, or maybe somehow I can explore it without being so afraid.
Well, there is a fear barrier you have to get over there. When I had my spontaneous Kundalini experiences at the age of 16, it was a devastating experience in one way for me because I lived in a small town in Maine. I had no idea what Kundalini was and or what yoga was. I mean, we didn't even know what yogurt was at that point in time, you know. But I will tell you that I underwent this spontaneous Kundalini experience at night when I was in my bed. It would come on when I was dreaming, usually when I was having a lucid dream, and it was accompanied by the most terrifying paralysis. And what happened is I was a 16-year-old kid. I would be having a lucid dream. I remember once I just dreamed I was with some other kids, and we were on a ski slope, and I was watching the other kids go down the slope, and then I looked at myself, and I thought, wait a minute, this is a dream, you know? And I woke up in the dream. at the same moment that I woke up in the dream, this fantastic surge of hot, cold, electrical current went through my body. The next thing I knew, I found myself laying in my bed. And I was completely paralyzed, and I mean paralyzed, unable to breathe. It, you know, my lungs were paralyzed. And it was a terrifying experience, and I had to work through it over 6 months. So the first thing is to get over the fear barrier. The second thing is that I would advise is to try, you know, this experience is going to recur, right? So set it up so that you're prepared for it, kind of like a hypnotic suggestion, you know? Prepare for it before it happens. And then when it happens, you'll be able to gradually gain more mobility in it. And it will gradually become an experience of exploration and rather than an experience where you are subjected to an overwhelming power. That's the best hit I can give you on the basis of my own history with that.
Does that help you, Robert?
That helps tremendously. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, absolutely, and thanks for calling so far in advance, and we called him back. I could not let him not talk to you.
No, you couldn't. You really couldn't. He had a question he had to ask. He asked the right person, didn't he?
Redlands, California, we go west of the Rockies. Phil, you're on with John Lash.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Phil.
Hi. I have a question about the seeding of the stars. Does your guest think that could have been with flying saucers doing the seeding or something along that area? Because the Bible seems to say that Ezekiel seen the wheel, says it looked like a wheel within the wheel. Could that have possibly been a flying saucer?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a category of books called biblical ufology, and it's largely based on this premise that the Bible, especially the Old Testament, contains a fair amount of UFO lore and so forth. One comes across that, of course, when in the study of myths, biblical ufology. I personally follow the ancient mystery teaching about the panspermia, the seeding of different worlds, and I do not believe that it is necessary to use ET hardware to accomplish the seeding. Now, I can't quote any myth on this that describes exactly how this seeding of life in various on various planets occurs. But, you know, there's a scientist called Lynn Margulis that I've met and talked to, had the fortune of speaking with her, and she's the mother of Gaia theory, James Lovelock being kind of the father. She's an evolutionary biologist, and she totally believes in panspermia. And what Lynn Margulis says is that there are propagules, she calls them, interesting word, propagules, P-R-O-P-A-G-U-L-E-S, which are kind of like freeze-dried units of amino acids, and that they can float through interstellar space. And so according to Lynn Margulis, and I would tend to follow her view, it's the dust is alive. The dust of interstellar space is alive, and it floats into the atmosphere of certain planets, settles into the water, into the pools, into the rock pools, and life begins. If that is so, why is there a need for it to be, as it were, technologically transplanted by UFOs?
Good point. Salt Lake City, Utah. Joe, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Joe.
Hey, I wanted to thank both of you for a great show. First of all, I'm really excited about the Dr. Sachs movie. So I love Kerouac, and Dharma Bums is just my favorite book of all time. You touched lightly on lucid dreams, and I was wondering in your research if you've ever come across anything like galantamine, like red spider lily, it's an herb, or Kalea zatatichi, I think it's called. Different things like that may have helped you. I try different techniques like the waking-induced lucid dreams, things like that. I think it's just such an important gateway to reconnecting with the earth and spirituality. So I was wondering if you could speak more about, and these things that I have, they're actually completely legal in the United States. Wormwood is another thing. It's growing outside my window right now, but I'm actually learning how to fly in my dreams. I resemble Woodstock, you know, the bird that flies with Snoopy, but I'm getting better. So it's like I just wanted you to talk about that because it might help people quite a bit out there, and I'll listen off later. Thanks.
Sure. Well, first I want to say that I'm also very excited about this Dr. Sachs movie that I'm basing on the Kerouac novel. And as far as the Dharma Bums goes, I just signed a contract for a film deal on the Dharma Bums. So apparently, if things work, there's going to be a film of the Dharma Bums coming out in about 3 years. So you might want to look for that, okay? Kerouac aside, there are many herbs and psychoactive plants that are reputed to help you focus and practice lucid dreaming. I think lucid dreaming is one of the most interesting spiritual technologies of our time and accessible to everyone. I can't give you in particular advice on which plants would be better or which techniques would be better, but it sounds like you're well on your way with it. And the important thing is to keep a journal of what you do and make a coherent record of what you do so that then you can impart it to others, and other people who are attempting the same method can benefit from your experience.
Good point. Next up, let's go to Jessica, Hammonds, Louisiana. You're up with us. First-time caller. Hi, Jess.
Hi, how are you tonight?
We're great, thanks.
All right. Well, I was listening earlier, and the doctor was talking about genetic effects of ETs on human beings. And in my spare time, I had done some research, some facial profiling of an ET compared to a human being today. And I got down to something very simple that were being in the likeness, and I typically call the ETs God, but that human beings were made in the likeness of God, but in the opposite, meaning that our eyes are still the typical shape, except smaller, white, but still have the core black within, meaning the pupil. That our noses are now protruding, our hearing perception receptors are on the outside as opposed to the inside of our bodies. And, I mean, we have teeth. So, but we still have blue within. So I'm not quite sure if any of the ETs are blue. I didn't. The photograph that I was looking at didn't really specify which type of ET it was, but it was definitely blue with the typical oversized black football shapes with the diamond nose and slits.
All right, let's get your take on that, John. We'll get your take on that, or your reaction to what she said.
Sure. With all due respect, to me that is completely demented fantasy material. And it's easy to make up things like that, and I would question whether that is a productive or helpful use of the imagination, because where do you get in the end? I have been warned off that kind of fantasy by what I learned from the Sophia myth. And one of the many things that can be extracted from the Sophia myth, I would put in this paraphrase, if I can give it to you in my best language.
Sure.
The human species is not the creation of any god whatsoever. Take that on board for breakfast. We are a projection of the imagination of a goddess being. And we can interact and know that very goddess being whose imagination produced us because she inhabits and indwells the earth. So this is what I learned, and I would rather go into that experimental scenario and see what I can learn than pursue these kinds of things that you're describing here. That's just my personal preference.
John, got to get your reaction to the work of Zechariah Sitchin. I'm pretty sure you're aware of what he did.
Sitchin, you know, I've read so much Sitchin. I mean, who hasn't?
That's
great stuff.
I mean, how
many times have you read all of those books? I think I've read them all maybe four times. You know?
I had him on the show about a month and a half ago. We had to. He was on for the first hour for a little bit. Interesting theory.
Yeah, it is an interesting theory. But, you know, there are very serious holes in Sitchin. I'm not going to go into that, you know, with the 13th planet. He never really describes what these Anunnaki beings are like. My view, and I've discussed Sitchin in Not in His Image. By the way, the title of my book, Not in His Image, is also an answer to your last caller. We are not created in any God's image, especially any male or ET aliens image. I believe that is a deluded fantasy of the human race that goes nowhere, because if it were true, so what, you know? So anyway, Sitchin, you know, believes that we have been genetically manipulated, and he's such a scholar. I mean, God, the man is an Egyptologist.
Yeah.
He reads Sumerian. How many ancient scripts does he read? I don't read one. You know, I just read what's on the cornflakes box. I don't read those scripts, you know? So, in a way, I feel intimidated, you know, to say anything about Sitchin. But
you?
I will tell you this.
Intimidated?
I know the Anunnaki myth he's drawing on,
yes,
as well as he does. And the seers of the ancient mystery schools who produced for us the Sophianic story had a very interesting fix on this Anunnaki story. You know, the Anunnaki created us and blah, blah, blah. They said that was just channeled by clairvoyants and psychics who wanted to please and flatter the potentates and Eastern kings and princes for whom they were, by whom they were employed, to convince those kings and princes that they were the progeny of a divine offspring.
And keep them around.
And keep them around, exactly.
That is fascinating. Let's go to Ohio. Mike, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Mike.
Good evening, George and John.
Hi.
That was fascinating. Quick comment before my question, George. The movie Contact depicts Jodie Foster's experience as being a mental experience. And, John, please, my two quick questions are, is our imagination or language how the Archons interact with us, and are the crop circles proof that the planet is communicating with us?
I'll take the second one first. I think that if we want to look at all the phenomena in the world today, the anomalous phenomena, the one that we can't just explain away by science, look at crop circles. Crop circles would present a very interesting, I would not say proof, but a very serious argument for the possibility that the Earth itself is communicating with us through this symbology, you know?
Yeah.
And it's very sophisticated. And, you know, there's a book by Freddie Silva, S-I-L-V-A,
yes,
called Secrets of the Fields, and he traces the evolution of these crop circles. And what impressed me most about Silva's book, apart from it being a good overview, is that he showed that they become more and more interactive with the researchers. The appearance of the circles is more and more interactive with the people who are investigating them. So that, to me, speaks for an interface between humans and the intelligence of the Earth, very, very much so. As far as human imagination is concerned, as I've said, the ancient sages of the mysteries said that we have this special gift, which they called the luminous epinoia. The luminous epinoia is the power of imagination. And everything depends on how we use it. Now, we can use it to make ourselves victims of an Archon or alien invader.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an event in your own imagination. And some of the events in your own imagination are fantasy material that cannot be tested. What you want to pay attention to is the things that you can imagine that can be tested. And in my view of what I'm teaching now, Planetary Tantra, is a way to use the imagination to interact with Gaia in ways that can be tested. When we can test our imagination, we know we're using it correctly. When we have to resort to more and more elaborate fantasy material, we're probably deviating.
Well, that's true, too. And this difference between those who are using their imagination for good and then those who are using the imagination for evil, you know, there's a clash in... you know, I think like you, John, eventually I think the good people, the good direction is going to pop up and win.
Well, I think the power of the imagination, which is a divine endowment, in my opinion, this is also what I've learned from my ancient studies, the power of imagination is basically the power of good. Look at children and look at the gift of the imagination they have and how they play.
Yes.
Inherent to the imagination is the desire to play and share and do good. But also inherent in the imagination is a certain element, not the dominant element. I agree with you, George. It's not the dominant element, the element of the wish to deceive. But that is not the dominant element of our imagination, and I do not believe that it will win out in the end. One of the great, great things that has happened to us since 9/11, not only in America but in the world, is that we're getting on to the fact that people who deceive are not to be allowed to continue deceiving, and they're not to be allowed to have their game go uncommented.
Absolutely.
You know?
One day it'll all cave in.
That's
I had
right.
an opportunity a couple days ago to be with my little year-and-a-half-old grandchild. And
oh, really?
he saw a bird. It must have been the first time he's ever seen one, at least when he was with me. Mm-hmm. You know, I go back and forth, so I don't spend that kind of time with these children. But the look on his face when he saw this bird go by was absolutely priceless.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was staring at it, and the bird kind of like was on a branch and stared back at him, and they were just looking at each other. Mm-hmm. And it was just absolutely priceless that, it's difficult to explain. We had to be there to see it. But there's this life connection with so many things on this planet. It's absolutely just unbelievable.
Well, you know, there's a wonderful line in one of these Nag Hammadi texts which says, if you would seek the divine imagination, look for it in the child under seven.
I like that. We'll be back in a moment with John Lash. We'll take your final phone calls with him, questions on Coast to Coast AM. Well, your Independence Weekend now officially underway. Lots of businesses just closing on Friday, so enjoy the 3 days with your friends and family. And if you're all alone as well, don't worry, because we will be here, family, for three live nights, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And Friday, of course, we'll have a program based on mysteries and monsters, and then open lines. We'll be back in a moment with Final Calls with John Lash on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, John Lash, and then we'll go to your final calls. John, any travel in the next few months for you?
Probably not. Just stay here in Southern Europe for most of the summer. I don't have anything on the agenda right now.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Anchorage, Alaska. Frenchie, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Frenchie.
Joe, I think that your guest is really good. John's really good and everything, but I think both of you guys would learn a lot to read the six-volume books of by Baird T. Spaulding, Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East, because when you read them books, when you ask questions, you're going to ask them not from wondering, but from a place of knowing. And I'll tell you what, it's going to just open your world, because it answers so many of your questions, George. When you ask a lot of your guests, all these questions that you ask will be answered in these books, I guarantee you.
What's the biggest thing, Frenchie, that you got from the books?
Well, I don't think it would do justice if I tried to explain, but it explains more fully about who and what and how God operates. And it just opens your consciousness to a great new dimensions, trust me.
Okay, I'll look into that. Let's go to Richard in Hammond, Louisiana. You are up with us. Hey, Richard, go ahead.
How y'all doing?
All is well.
Great. Listen up. By listening to y'all's show, I've been listening for a while, since 2005. Anyway, I came up with a scenario / theory about how the Earth was formed.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been trying to get through to y'all, but tonight's a perfect night, I think.
All right.
Anyway, you know how y'all always say that, or have said, he had a guest that said that we have a bi-star system, like our sun had a sister star?
Yes.
Okay, and then also there was another show where they said that the Earth collided with another planet
at
one time in the past.
Yes.
Well, my theory, they got me thinking that possibly our planet used to be the second star, okay? And then we have planets all over our galaxy made of different substances. So we have gas giants, correct?
All right, I'm with you.
All right, so maybe there was a planet made of nothing but water that collided with the second star in our system, which is us, and put that star out, extinguished it. But, I mean, when something like that happens, it just doesn't go out, you know, at one moment. It had to, you know, the water had to boil and evaporate, which formed our atmosphere. And
well, now, what would a physicist say about this one, John Lash? Thanks, Richard, by the way.
I don't know. I'm not a physicist. I can only respond as a mythologist.
You're the mythologist.
Yeah, and as a mythologist, I would say that I feel very relieved, personally, that I find
the stories or origin stories of the planet contained in myths, and that saves me from the trouble of having to cook up my own myth to explain how it happened.
You know, the Nag Hammadi, mm-hmm. how were they discovered?
They were discovered by accident by a peasant who was looking for manure in a cave, and then it was quite a few years before the people who discovered them realized the significance of them and
of what they had. Yeah,
yeah. And as I explain in my book, Not in His Image, they have a double whammy in the Nag Hammadi books that were discovered in Egypt in 1945. A double whammy was, on the one hand, they contain this elements of this Sophia creation myth of the earth, which is spectacular and beautiful and coherent.
Go ahead.
And the other is that they contain a very, very severe critique of Judeo-Christian religion and the beliefs in the Father God.
Where are the books now?
Well, I think they're kept in the Coptic Library in Cairo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Probably under lock and key.
And they are books, by the way. I point out something that's interesting. They're papyrus leaves that were cut and bound and covered in leather covers. They're very small, like a large woman's pocketbook. You know, they're not big. But they are actually the first known examples we have of bound books.
Let's go to Will driving to Las Vegas. Come back a winner, Will.
Hey, how's it going, fellas?
Good.
Honor. Quick question about dimethyltryptamine and the pineal gland.
Mm.
And I've been fascinated with research with DMT, and I'm wondering if you have any insight on lucid dreaming and the pineal gland and the universe you kind of go to with these different beings. I always catch up with some Trey Manis-looking dudes. And
sure.
All right, John, can you address that?
The DMT experience is very unusual because, you know, Terrence McKenna and others have written about it a lot.
Yeah.
It's one of the experiences that one can have with a psychoactive substance that seems to consistently provide exactly the same result, exactly the same scenario. The scenario of seeing these Manis-like beings or hobbits or trolls, or sometimes people describe them as ET archon entities. I don't know. My best guess would be, I don't know how to connect it with the pineal gland, but my best guess would be that DMT is a substance provided by nature that Gaia herself has provided to give us a glimpse into another dimension. But what is the purpose of glimpsing that? I would be very hard put to say. And no one seems to have come up with a purpose. So it's a fascinating and repetitive experience, but what's the point of it?
John, tell me a little bit about the experiment undertaking with this interactiveness with Gaia.
Yeah, I use the word interactive, and I'm glad you brought that up, George. Thank you very much. There are two kinds of myths that you will discover if you go read into the mythology of the world. One of them I call static myth. For instance, there's a Greek myth that says there was a boy called Icarus, and his father was a designer or builder who built some wings, who constructed some wings out of bird feathers. And then Icarus took these wings, and he attached them to his shoulders with wax, and he flew. But when he got too close to the sun, the wax melted, and he fell. Okay, this is a myth. You can read it any way you want. Maybe it's a metaphor about human pride, or let's not get too involved in our technology. It might let us down, or, you know. But it's a static myth. It just tells a message or a story. You can't really interact with it. Interactive myth, for example, would be the myth of the American Indians, the Dakota Sioux, whatever, who say white buffalo woman was a spiritual being, came out of the earth, and brought to the tribes the sacred pipe, and taught them the ceremony of smoking the sacred pipe and looking in the four directions. That's an interactive myth, because actually the tribal people still continue to perform that ceremony. Whereas with the myth of Icarus, there's no ceremony that you can perform. So there's a big difference, and I'm teaching now, or hoping to teach, aiming to teach, a kind of interactive process with Gaia that is based on this Sophia mythology and that uses certain tools relating to the power of the divine feminine. I can't really paraphrase it very well because we're down to the last couple of minutes here. But if you go and look at the planetary tantra section of my site, you'll get an idea of what I'm developing there. It's a result of a fantastic experience I had last year in the summer, kind of a mystical or spiritual awakening. I've had a fairly good number of them through my life, but this one was top of it all.
This was the Bing, right?
This was the big Bing. This was the crowning one for me. I'm very lucky to be kind of, I could call myself a natural-born mystic, okay? I think many of us are. We have these mystical experiences. Don't deny them. Don't pretend that they don't happen. But don't, you know, we have to develop and understand what these experiences are. Anyway, out of that experience, I'm offering this idea that we can interact with the intelligence of the planet and interact with nature. And I'm trying to develop some parameters of how we might do this. It's totally open source spirituality, George. I have no agenda to peddle. I'm not trying to be a guru. I'm just sharing my own experiences as they might be relevant to other people on the same wavelength.
That's fair enough, and that's all you can really ask for.
That's all we can, any of us can do, isn't it?
Hacienda Heights, California, west of the Rockies. Kim, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi, gentlemen. Oh, what an honor to talk to you. Long-time listener, first-time caller. And my question for you, Mr. Lash, oh, what a flood of information in my mind going off. Is it possible in the explanation that you gave for the Kundalini experience to be had in a more minute sense and not know it until I heard your explanation of it?
Mm-hmm.
It is? Okay, good. Because I've had it several times, and I'm not sure what it was. It just was in association with other things like a presence or something like that I felt around me. So it was very
strange. Exactly. Yeah. Well, there are two ways to have the Kundalini experience. You can have this spectacular rush of the Kundalini up the spine, which is unmistakable, you know, which is what I had. And it went on pretty much two or three times a week for 6 months. Wow. So by the end of that period, I was rather blasted away. But since then, I've also learned, I mean, now my emphasis in my own practice and in my mystical experience, as it were, is what I call full-body Kundalini. And this is much more an experience of a kind of electrical, blissful feeling that flows through your entire body. It doesn't shock you and jolt you in the way that the classic upsurge of Kundalini does. And actually, I feel that full-body Kundalini is something that happens to us when we're attuning to the ambience of Gaia's beauty and her love and tenderness. It's a feeling of deep tenderness. And so this may be more along the line of the Kundalini experiences that you're having.
Shamans, they seem to have an incredible innate ability to do some things. Have you studied them with regards to the ancient shamans?
Well, the ancient shamans were the ones who produced the Nag Hammadi materials and ran the mystery schools. And, of course, I have studied them most deeply, and the results of what I have learned from them will be found in not in his image.
When I was a kid, John, I thought alchemists of the ancient days were just trying to make gold. And the older I got and the more I studied, I realized it was far more than just gold.
That's just the cover story.
Yeah. That's a good point. Let's go to Long Island, New York. Howard, thanks for holding. You're up with us.
Yeah. Hello, gentlemen. I've been listening, and I've been listening for some time to the program. I'm also a first-time caller. And my question is really about the nature of our activities on planet Earth. And my question would be to John would be whether or not he has some sort of theory about whether or not there is some sort of life, let's say, after death, and whether or not the activities that we participate while we are living on this planet color, in fact, what happens if there is some sort of reincarnation or time after death for the spirit. What's your take on that, first of all? And then my second point and question would be is when I listen to the program frequently, where I am at least, there are all these commercials for investing in gold. You know, our activities are continually centered upon material acquisitions, our place in society. People are always pursuing different life paths. George is talking about this moment where he's viewing his grandchild view a bird, and at the same time, you know, given the constructs of radio and and the way things should go in the society. There's need for this constant pushing of some other kind of construct. Let's say it's diametrically opposed to the bird moment that George's grandchild is experiencing.
Well, to me, the bird moment of that child is a moment when we get a flash of our own divine intelligence, and that whenever I get that flash, it's always connected with nature directly. I can't experience the divine intelligence that's endowed in me apart from nature. I guess my final word would be that the highest technology on this planet is the technology of our own bodies and senses, and we're going to be taken back to that technology with the breakdown of this materialistic system, which doesn't serve Gaia anymore and doesn't even serve us, does it?
And whether we want to or not, I think you're
whether
right,
we want to or not. And the beautiful thing is we will be taken back to the primal technology of the senses and the deep knowing of our senses in connection with her, but not in separation from the living planet ever.
Will there be an awakening? I happen to believe that Coast to Coast listeners, for example,
yeah,
are more in tune to what
yeah
you're saying than most people who aren't listeners.
Sure, but sure.
Will there
sure
be an awakening where those people, something hits them, and they start to say, my gosh, we've been doing this wrong for years?
I don't think so. I'm not counting on it, George, to be totally honest with you. You know, yeah, I've written a whole book on 2012 that's on MetaHistory.org, and one of the points I make in there is I believe that we are coming to an awakening. As I said, 2012 is a horizon, a window of opportunity toward the distant future of our species, but it's a selective awakening and not a collective one. You know, the saddest thing about the experience of enlightenment is that even though it's available to all of us, many people will count themselves out of it.
True, true.
And so those people are not going to have the benefit that enlightenment brings, which is to bring us back to freedom, respect, and cooperation with each other. That is what you realize when you have an enlightened moment. And so they won't play. And they won't play, and they'll go their own way. But I just want to play.
The
with
right
others
way
who are playing.
Yeah. Murdoch in Phoenix, Arizona. First-time caller. Murdoch, go ahead. A couple minutes for you.
Hi, George. Johnny, I got a quick question. Great
sure
show. John, have you ever heard of the laws of light? And I'll take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
The laws of light.
Yeah, the laws of light. I haven't heard of that particular thing, but there are many, you know, books and teachings floating around to have been received, channeled, or to have been received by various masters. To me, you know, the greatest story of light is this story of the spike or plume of light that came from the galactic center, and the idea that our planet could have been produced as a result of that spike. To me, that's a great story of light, and that's the one that I like to dwell upon.
God, if we ever invent time travel, John, I'd love for you to go back to that moment where those 16 shamans were writing the Nag Hammadi and just have you witness what they were doing. I think that would be fascinating.
I tend to float back there now and then, George, here, just when I'm sitting around having my afternoon tea, you know. So it's a genre and an environment that I remember very well. And it was great to have that community of people who work together spiritually and united by the same vision. And I have a feeling that's going to happen again.
You know, you could be a reincarnated one of them. You never know.
It has been pointed out suspiciously that this may be the case, but I make no comment.
All right. John, I want to thank you for an enlightening program. God, good luck in everything you do. If there's anything we can do to help you, just make the phone call, okay?
You bet, George. Thanks for an enjoyable conversation, and the best to you.
All right. And when you're in L.A., just look us up. John's website, Meta, M-E-T-A, history.org, metahistory.org. If you need to email me, that's George at coasttocoastam.com. And don't forget, three live nights now over the holidays for you, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.
Every day I ask, what can